Hi, everybody. Hal Eisner here. Thanks for joining us again for another episode of What the Hal? I love saying that. I really do. It's fun. You know, something about my name that it's sort of, you can do all kinds of things with it. And so it's kind of fun when I can play with my name a little bit. Anyway, this week we're talking about something that I've certainly researched a lot over the years. I've done a lot of stories about it, and that's water here in California. But you know what? There's also some unsung heroes in this state, and those are the people that work for our public works departments that get out there and clean our basins. They protect our streets with K-rails. They do all kinds of things to make sure that when big, bad storms come through, that we're all in some way or another safe. And so, meet my guest. Let's start by everybody introducing themselves.
Hi, my name's Jeff Pratt. I'm the Director of Public Works for Ventura County.
Hi, thanks, Al. Shannon Weedor, Strategic Communications Officer, Orange County Public Works.
Dan Lafferty, Deputy Director, LA County Department of Public Works.
And Steve Frazier, Public Information Officer for LA County Public Works.
So one of the things we're doing is we're public works departments don't always get a lot of attention in the sense that people immediately think of the public works department.
Absolutely.
Right?
Not.
Yes. But that's what we're doing because you have a lot of people. Actually, I'm kind of curious. How many people do you have in the Ventura County Public Works Department?
400.
400. What do you have in Orange?
Orange County, we have just over 900.
900. And what about LA County?
We're about 3,600.
About 3,600. And so that gives you an idea of all the people that go to work every day and man those trucks or get out there with those shovels or the skip loaders or the bulldozers, and they're cleaning out the mud and the muck and all that kind of stuff. And the whole purpose is to protect us. The whole purpose is to make sure that we don't have a bad mud flow or some kind of a debris flow or a flash flood or something that causes our homes to be impacted, for our lives to be impacted. And so there's a lot of strategy that goes into how to deal with Mother Nature and protect those of us who live in these communities. So let's start with Jeff and kind of pick up where I just left off.
Well, so a lot of people don't know that public works are first responders, actually by federal law. And really, the only time you ever notice public works at all is when it's not working. We're pretty good at what we do. It's partially an explanation for why you don't know us.
Because you're hidden in the shadows.
That's right. We keep it running, you know, and as long as it's running, you're not hearing about us. But, you know, technically we're first responders, and we're right there shoulder to shoulder with the typical people you think of when you say public safety, fire and sheriff.
Well, one of the things that I'm going to do here is, as I think of something, I'm just going to ask it. So I'm not going to necessarily go in any particular order. But, Jeff, I've been in the area where you have this automated bagging machine. It's a sandbagging machine. It was introduced a couple of years ago. I remember doing a story about it. And I thought it was pretty interesting because it's like an assembly line. There are prisoners who are assigned to do this. It's like making license plates, but they work on this project. And they put the bags out there, and there's a little funnel, and the sand goes in, and then they move that off to the next bag. And how's that work?
It works great. We buy the sandbags for them to fill, and then they fill them, and then we distribute them throughout the community. You know, you can find them at police stations and fire stations near your home and anywhere in Ventura County.
But how's that been received? I mean, oftentimes what we do is we go to a fire station, there's a big old mound of sand and a shovel.
All right. Yeah, there you see that. Yeah. We get both. We get the people who like to fill their own for whatever reason. They're afraid of what might be in there because they're hard to dispose of after you've employed them, right? And then we like the people who like to have them filled. The problem with the filled things is that you show up with a sedan, you're not taking very many away at a time. So, but we've had tremendous positive response, and we've always had asks for the filled bags.
Do any of you guys in your counties have these sandbagging machines, Dan? Do you have them?
No, not the machines. We still do it with a pile of sand in the bags and let folks have at it. So,
well, is there a big expense for those machines, or are they very expensive?
I don't know the answer to that question. I shouldn't think so. I mean, relatively speaking, to the
So LA isn't doing it, not because it's cost prohibitive.
No, we haven't. You know, the folks that come to us looking for sandbags are very used to the methodology that we've got. Quite frankly, I hadn't even heard that you guys had automated sandbag fillers.
But, I'm going to tell you, they're pretty cool. I mean, it's worth taking a look at. I said, I did a story on that, and when they first introduced them, and I thought, well, now isn't that clever because it's just an assembly line. And the prisoners just put the bag under, and in goes the sand, and out goes the bag. And it's a pretty unique system. Do you guys have that in Orange County?
Likewise, in Orange County, much like L.A., we have more of the old-school, low-tech sandbags that we do. We have crews and staff prepare those. Starting in the fall, we want to make sure they're on hand. I know we partner a lot with Orange County Fire Authority. They're a great resource as well at their fire stations.
Well, the fire departments for all the counties are great resources, and they're very important because they really are these frontline first responders that end up in these situations of pulling people out of cars, pulling people out of homes. Any kind of a disaster, the firefighters are right there. And I think credit to them as well. Dan, you know, we talk about infrastructure. There's a massive infrastructure in Los Angeles County. You got the LA River. You've got all kinds of flood control channels, all this stuff going out into the ocean. And there are a couple of catch nets on the way out to try to catch things before they get to where the fish are. But, you know, this is a big process, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, our infrastructure, we've been in existence since 1914, and we've spent a couple of years
before I was born.
Just a few. we've spent a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of energy building the system as it is, and it does, by and large, exactly what it was designed to do. The Flood Control District has a dual mission, protect and conserve. It's protect from floodwaters and conserve those floodwaters for beneficial use. And it does a great job at both. It is an extraordinary storm that overtaxes the system. The folks that designed that and built it knew what they were doing and left us with a great system that is it's up to us to make sure that we're making it right for the next generation to follow. But the fact that they put in the system that's there is a testament to some really good forward thinking and some dedicated folks.
I'm fascinated by the LA River. It really is a big concrete flood channel. And when there hasn't been rain, it's kind of dry. And trees growing in the middle of it, and maybe a critter here and a critter there, and somebody drives their car in and decides to use it as a racetrack. But, you know, the bottom line is it's a very large flood control channel. And when we do get these incredible rains, it becomes a raging river.
Yeah, you know, if we do have one of the nice things about an agency is the length of your memory. And, you know, we talk about the 1938 flood as if it was yesterday. And the photos that are around the department, you know, show, you know, what it was like back then. We had some huge rains.
So talk about the 1938 flood, because there may be a lot of people that really don't know what that is. And honestly, I don't know a lot about the 1938 flood.
So the 1938 flood is the largest flood that is on record in L.A. County. As I indicated, the Flood Control District was formed in 1914, and we were in the midst of constructing much of what I would call the backbone system, the reservoirs up in the foothills and the major channels down through the basin. When that storm came through, it was a very specific event. It was a three-day storm. The last day had the highest rainfall totals, and it just absolutely devastated much of the LA Basin.
Was it one of those slow-moving storms that sort of just kept drenching the area underneath it?
It lasted for many hours, and it was a lot of rain in that time period, which are, you know, the two things that really lead up to a disastrous storm. If you've got an extended storm period and you've got heavy rains throughout that period, you're going to see a lot of runoff.
So is this a fair statement that you can do so much, but then when Mother Nature trumps you in some way or another and surprises you with some kind of an isolated storm that just sits over your house, there's just not much you can do about that?
Well, you know, Mother Nature bats last. And so you can put whatever preparations you want. And if the time is ripe and the situation and the climate is right, you're going to find yourself in something that you just didn't design for. We've had situations where you find one of these storm cells that just parks over an area and dumps enough rain in 15 minutes to be equal to once in a 500-year event. And you just do not design your system to handle that type of flow.
I'm going to remember that line, Mother Nature bats last. Oh,
she does, and she does a great job when she puts her mind to it.
Well, she can be very destructive.
Absolutely.
You know, I've seen some pretty gnarly things to her credit or discredit. Shannon, what do you add to that?
Well, I look at a flood control system anywhere, really, not just Orange County, but it's much like the freeway system. I think most people can relate to traffic, freeways. You get a whole network of, you know, arterial roads, smaller residential roads that feed into the larger freeways. flood control system works much just like that. You have neighborhood gutters, storm drains that feed into these larger channels. And it is a big investment with taxpayer dollars that keep them safe operationally. So, you know, it is a huge commitment. We use those taxpayer dollars. I think our current capital improvement program over the next 7 years calls for over just over $400 million just for our flood control projects alone. You know, right now in Orange County, one of the largest floodplains is the north, northern, central, coastal Orange County, like the Garden Grove, Huntington Beach, Stanton, Westminster area. And we're preparing for a very large project with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We have a study underway, and anywhere we're looking at a range of projects, anywhere up to $1 billion for those improvements along some of those major channels. Because stemming from floods in the early 1900s from along the Santa Ana River, that's what really stemmed and formed the Orange County Flood Control District. And that's, you know, over time we built those channels, but a lot of the flood control system is built to those old standards. And that's what we're doing now throughout the entire year. These projects that we're using taxpayer dollars for is to upgrade those channels, build capacity, and keep those communities safe. That's our core mission.
I know that people probably realize it takes a lot of money, but that's really a lot of money. I mean, well, you know, you're talking about a very significant chunk of change when you're talking about millions of dollars and billions of dollars. Steve Frazier and I have known each other a long time. And Shannon and I have known each other for quite a while. And Steve and I have gone to a number of different places when we've done stories about public works. And one of the things I thought was kind of interesting that you and I did was down along the LA River near Long Beach, where there's a net down there, and it catches bottles and plastic and styrofoam and all these things that get thrown into the LA River before it gets into the ocean. How effective is that kind of a catch?
Well, the trash boom is the last line of defense before the LA River flow goes out into the Pacific Ocean at Long Beach. But communities all up and down the river system also have filters along their catch basins to try to capture as much trash as possible. There are water quality standards that all of the cities as well as the county have to try to meet. But this is also an area where we really rely on the public to do their part, because keeping litter out of the curbs and out of parking lots helps keep it out of the water system and being flushed away in a storm.
You know, if you talk to Heal the Bay, or if you go down to the museum, it's not really a museum, it's an aquarium that they have at the Santa Monica Pier, you can see examples of all the garbage that ends up in the ocean. And it's pretty unfortunate.
It is. Litter is something that's been on the public radar at least since 1965, 70. There's greater public awareness all the time, but we can never rest on our laurels. There's always a better job that all of us can be doing. And that goes beyond public agencies, right down to families and individuals. Everyone needs to do their part, because every little piece ends up accumulating with everybody else's little piece and causes us a problem that we try to catch at that trash boom.
And not just us, it causes the sea life.
Yes.
Incredible death. I mean, you know, you can have some very serious consequences among the critters that live in the ocean.
And in the river channels, because we do have a lot of wildlife that uses all of our channels as estuaries and wetlands on the way to the ocean. And wildlife is especially vulnerable to plastic waste and bits of foil and whatnot that get suspended in the river. And again, I can't emphasize enough how much we depend on the public to do their part to help all of us do our jobs and protect those resources.
It's interesting. The public sort of messaging that I tend to hear most is about saving your life and having go kits and doing things that are going to keep you from being in the crosshairs. I don't know that I hear a lot in the public media about, you know, the necessity to go find a garbage can instead of the LA River.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to think that it's just my little piece of litter. It's just my plastic coffee cup. It's just my spoon. It's just my stir stick. My little bit won't make that big of a difference. But when you and I were down at the trash boom, we saw pounds and pounds of all manner of material that accumulates because everyone's little bit mixes with this huge area of millions of people And it just the impact is incredible when you see all of those little bits put together in one place.
It's really true. It's really true. Dan, let me ask you about what kind of situation you face when you have repeated storms, one after another, a Pineapple Express kind of situation like we've seen this winter in Southern California.
So the real challenge for us as an agency when you get these back-to-back-to-back storms is the limited amount of time you have in between to manage the results of the prior storm. You know, the way that we do water conservation, for example, is to take the flows that fall on the flat parts of the county and infiltrate those into our basins first and then hold up into the mountains the rain that creates the runoff in those mountains and hold that behind our reservoirs. And then when that storm is over, we'd like to move that water down from the reservoirs and into our spreading grounds to do two things. One, supplement that water in the groundwater, but two, open up that storage for rains that are coming in the next storm so that it increases our ability to have effective flood control. The other thing that happens, especially in the fire areas, we find that a lot of sediment comes down with each storm. And when you have back-to-back-to-back storms, it is really challenging to get that sediment out so that you are creating the storage space you need for the sediment coming in the next storm. And it's a real problem because it's not just about the timing. That material is very difficult to haul when it's so wet. So you need to allow it to drain some before you can actually put it in a truck and haul it away. So those are the two biggest challenges.
You know, when you think about these catch basins, I've been in them, and maybe a lot of people haven't, and so they don't know exactly what we're talking about. But a catch basin is just what it is. It's a basin that's almost like a funnel, and what comes in drains out. And so you have to send bulldozers in periodically to scoop out the sediment that's gotten to the bottom of the basin like it were a bottom of a bathtub. The spreading grounds, that's another term I'm not sure a lot of people necessarily understand. But if I get it, the spreading grounds are a place to spread out the water so it percolates down. I think of percolating as percolating up, but it works its way down into the aquifers, which are underground storage areas that our water goes into. And when we're low in those aquifers, it's like having an empty tank of gas. And when we're full in those aquifers, it's like we're in good shape. And so if I have that right, where are we with these aquifers?
So, you know, we have had a couple of what I would call wet seasons, this year in particular, last year. And prior to that, though, we'd had 7 years of below average rainfall. What happens when you have below average rainfall, and it's really about the statewide dynamic. You know, California's water system is interconnected north to south. And, you know, there are components of the water supply for Southern California that originate in Northern California and at the Colorado River. So when you have a statewide drought and those supplies are diminished, what ends up happening is the people in the South basically hit the pumps. They begin pumping that groundwater out to make up the difference between the demand and the supplies that are short throughout the rest of the state. And we've had 7 years where supplies were short throughout the rest of the state. So those pumps have been hit hard for the last 7 years or so. As a result, those groundwater levels are significantly depleted. And the fact that you happen to have had 2 years where those rainfall totals were above average is just simply nowhere near enough to make up the difference for all the pumping that occurred during the drought to make sure that all the folks here could take showers and cook and drink water so that it's going to take time for those aquifers to fully recover.
I want to ask you about the river project because Governor Brown, who's now out of office, had wanted to do something with the Sacramento Delta, to do something that would make it better for water flow coming out of the north, I guess, to the south. But where are we on that sort of a project? I know a lot of that stuff gets political, but I mean, how important is that? We get much of our water from the north.
Well, when you talk about reliability, that is the benefit of the project that was being put forward. The Twin Tunnels project through the Delta would have made the supplies from Northern California more reliable than they have been in recent years. The fact that you could build the infrastructure to make sure that you could deliver those flows in a way that was not detrimental to the habitat in San Francisco Bay would have made a big difference in knowing that year in and year out, the amount of water that could be delivered to the south was going to be reliable. Without those tunnels, we're still going to be able to get water through the system. The problem is that it is really subject then to a lot of what is occurring in the Bay Delta at the time. And taking into account the impacts to habitat and how that affects how much water you can move through. And in certain times, you're going to be restricted, whereas if you had those tunnels, those restrictions wouldn't exist.
It's really interesting to me about water in California. There was a movie, Chinatown. There was a fellow named William Mulholland. There's always been this sort of thing between the northern part of the state and the southern part of the state when it comes to water. It's kind of almost like gold, isn't it?
Well, yes. You know, was it Mark Twain that said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting? And that pretty much kind of describes the situation when it comes to water in California. I think that throughout the state, actually, the focus and the effort that is put forward by regular citizens, you know, all of us that live here, that we're more aware, we're more conscious about the way we use water than we ever have been before. When you look at the per capita consumption in Southern California, despite population increases that are truly, you know, double-digit growth, the amount of water that we're using is very close to where we were in the late 70s and early 80s. And so here we have absorbed all of those additional people, all of that additional demand, and yet haven't actually created the supplies are still the same, and what we're delivering is still the same because people have conserved.
It's kind of interesting that water is such a political thing from time to time, but in the final analysis, it's we all need it. We all need it.
Yeah. You certainly can't live without it.
And you know, I got to tell you, I thought that Mother Nature's at bat was the best line I had heard today. I think Mark Twain may have just trumped that. And do you want to try to see if you can come up with one better one on water being a real political tool?
No, I think I've thrown my two out there for the day. I think I'm at my quota.
This is very good metaphors. Shannon, what do you think about some of what we're talking about and the significance of water and the ability for us to make sure that we always have it?
Yeah, like you said, water is key, just like oil, especially following 7 years of drought. And I think as public agencies, you know, we need to walk the talk. You know, we encourage folks to conserve and do their part because it's a dual process. Public agencies, we're doing what we can. There's a large investment. Public can obviously do their share. I know us at Orange County Public Works, we just completed a project at one of our facilities in the city of Orange. We call it a retrofit project where we made our parking areas permeable pavement. We included some bioswales, which is some nice landscaping to capture water. So,
describe the permeable pavements.
So it looks you're looking at a parking lot. Might be a little bit grainier. So with the rain, basically, there's you know hard to detect by the eye, but small openings where the water can actually, instead of running to the gutters, running down the street and kind of losing that, is basically filtrating through the parking lot structure, the pavement. Into the groundwater basin. We capture a lot of it, try to treat that as well. So we try to take that upon ourselves to walk the talk, and that's use that as a pilot system, but try to also educate others as well. We've had some tour groups from UC Irvine come look at the facility. We've tried some other agencies to do that. So it's a big part of what we do as well. We're not just building roads and flood channels, but there is a huge environmental component to what we do.
You know, I remember when we when we were having all these issues with water, and Governor Brown suggested that we should get rid of our pretty little green patches of grass, I think that's how he put it, and put in rocks, that we live in a semi-desert kind of environment. So I did it. And I have succulents and rocks, and I got to tell you, and this is really a complete aside, but you know, I changed everything into low-flow water. And, I never used to walk by my yard and say, well, golly gee, look at that. There's a new blade of grass. Never. But now I walk by my yard and I say, wow, look at that flower coming out of that succulent. I didn't know it would do that. It's just interesting when you do make changes, when you do conserve, when you try other ways of doing things, that they can be eye-opening in a lot of different ways. How effective has some of that been in Ventura County? Did a lot of people like me, and I happen to live in Ventura County, did a lot of people like me take advantage of the opportunity to turn their grass and put in rocks?
They absolutely did, it was very effective. I don't have numbers for everybody. We got 173 water agencies in Ventura County. But it gets at what Dan was talking about. Conservation has been a key cornerstone of the water supply efforts, and we've made great strides. But as you point out, there's more to make. And I'll underline that with the statement that all the cheap water's gone. So this is going to cost you money from now on, whether you're talking about the source control that Steve was mentioning or you're talking about future water supply. It's going to hit your pocketbook, so maybe that will help you change your behavior.
Use less.
Use less water and don't throw your trash in the stream and expect somebody else to pick it up. It's a lot more expensive to pick it up down in the end than it is for you to put that in the garbage. And you are going to pay in the end. That's called source control. And with the conservation, the more we conserve, the less water costs in general, the less water we purchase, right?
What do you mean we don't have any cheap water anymore?
It's gone. So the cheap water forever has been what comes from the state and what gets pumped from the ground. Groundwater being probably orders of magnitude, in some cases cheaper. So acre foot of water to pump out of the ground is about $100 if all things being even. An acre foot of state water is about $1,500. An acre foot of seawater that's been treated is approaching $3,000 to $4,000 an acre foot. An acre foot of reclaimed water from our groundwater basins that need to be treated before you use it, probably running somewhere in that $2,000 an acre foot. So cheap water is $100 an acre foot. State water is $1,500, the stuff that comes from the north, round numbers, by the time it's delivered. And all the rest of the water supplies we'll be developing are very expensive.
I'm thinking diet soda now. What do you think?
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing that we need water. We're all about water, right? What sort of a final thought from everybody. What is your feeling about the future of reclaiming water, about the future of trying to get people to understand that there is no cheap water anymore, and the less you use, the less it's going to cost you, and that sort of thing? Shannon.
I think it seems like there's more and more pressure for people to take action, not only individuals, but as public agencies. And I think you're starting to get a little bit more buy-in, and the reason of why we have a lot of these projects and initiatives underway, why water districts are taking this initiative for water conservation, or even, you know, the seawater desalination projects you see out there, they're costly, but it seems like they'll come a crossroads when they'll cross paths where these other new technologies, it's going to take some time, may become a little bit cheaper, but as the population grows, you see more development, particularly in Southern California. There's some added pressure.
I do want to do a quick round on desalination. I've been to the plant in San Diego County, in Carlsbad, where they have this huge desalination plant, which is basically like a reverse osmosis system for a monster-sized sink. You know what I mean? It's basically the same science. And there's one in Catalina, a small one. The water from that, I think, is used more for things like toilets and things of that nature as opposed to drinking water. But Dan, is there a future for desalination? We have all that water out there in the ocean.
So the problem with ocean desal is it's really expensive. I think there is a place for desalination, but what we're talking about with that is what I would say is brackish water, you know, where you've got some infiltration from the ocean into some of these groundwater basins that you can, you know, stick a well in there and pump that out and take the salt out of that water. The cost to desalinate brackish water is significantly less.
And
it's still expensive.
Brackish means?
It's kind of a blend between ocean water, which is truly straight up salt water, and fresh water. So you're somewhere in between. Oftentimes, you know, half to a third of the level of chloride content that you're going to see in ocean water, you'll see in brackish water. So it's not as energy intensive. And that's the big problem with desal. It's not quite having to build a power plant every time you build a desal plant, but it's fairly close. It takes an awful lot of energy to push that water through those membranes and get all that salt out. And then you've got a problem of disposal. The brine that results from a desal plant is very difficult to get rid of in a way that is environmentally friendly. So there are still a variety of other options available. You know, Jeff talked about, you know, our reclaimed water from sewage treatment plants. I know people don't want to think of having your sewage treatment plant connected to your water plant, but at the end of the day, that's where we're going to end up. It's a very valuable, local, sustainable, reliable supply. People are flushing their toilets. They're doing laundry all the time. If you can grab that water and you can treat it and you can clean it to drinking water standards, that's where we need to be moving towards. It's going to take some time to get there. There's a lot of effort underway already to do that. A lot of that water currently is being spread in those spreading grounds that we talked about to help recharge local supplies as well. But if we can begin thinking about actually piping it, I think that's really where we're going to see the biggest change in our culture as it relates to water.
When was the point that we had cheap water and all of a sudden it wasn't cheap anymore? All of a sudden everything changed.
Yeah, that was probably about in the 60s or so.
So you what know, happened?
Population boom. Post-World War II, you know, Southern California became a destination. And we had a huge influx of folks that came in. The population spiked. You've got to get water to all those people. And so you needed to begin developing more expensive sources of water to make sure that that happened. And to Jeff's point, a lot of those alternative sources, places where you could put reservoirs and all the good spots are gone. You know, if there were good spots left, we'd be building. So the easy answers and the cheap water has all pretty much been developed.
So do you guys sit around a table at work and you scratch your head and say, so how do we do this now?
Yes. Dan's point, it's about direct potable reuse. That really is. It's already happening. It's happening in other parts of the world, and it's at the table discussion at the state and the local levels here. So we've got some in Ventura County that's already prepared, but we're using it for irrigation at this point, not yet for drinking.
Yeah, I was going to say, where is that? I'm going to stay away. I'm all about conservation and stuff, but that my taste for that isn't there yet. You know,
It's not that long. It's not that long a shot. I used to live in St. Louis, and the drinking water for the city of St. Louis came out of the Mississippi River, and the drinking water for the county of St. Louis came out of the Missouri River. And I could tell you that water got used many times before it got to St. Louis. So it's happening.
There is no new water on this planet. Every drop of water that you're drinking has been around the hydrologic cycle. So if you think about the times of the dinosaurs, that dinosaur piss is now water that you're drinking. So there is no new water.
And what do the astronauts do?
Whoa. Here's the bottom line. We can talk about these things. They're part of our community. What the hell? Right?
What the hell?
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guest. And I learned a lot during that conversation. I really did. Well, look. Thanks for being part of this podcast. If you don't subscribe, please do. I hope you'll become a regular subscriber. And you can do that through whatever outlet you get your podcasts from. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next time.